So we are making it easier to live a smarter life by skimming it for you and by making it easier to make decisions. Whether it's here's the news that you need in the world around you, these are the events that you need to know about are coming up and they're in your calendar, to these are the product recommendations that we're making, we are making it easier to be an adult.
5 million.
Okay. Well, we're not allowed to say active. 5 million active.
Yes.
And you define active users as?
Open a few times a week.
A few times a week. Mm-hmm. So once a week isn't enough?
No.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot of people. Mm-hmm.
I'm John Fort from CNBC, and you're listening to the Fort Knox Podcast, Rich Ideas and Powerful People. I do this weekly, bringing you the highest achievers. We're going to learn how the very best climb to the top and pull out lessons along the way. If that sounds good to you, make this a habit. Subscribe on Apple's podcast app, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play. Tell a friend. This week on the podcast, Danielle Weisberg and Carly Zakin, co-founders and co-CEOs of The Skim. Their core product, The Daily Skim, a newsletter targeting millennial women that keeps you up to date on what's happening in the world. Now, they didn't invent the daily newsletter by a long shot, but Weisberg and Zakin are working the kind of magic with it that should make every media executive in the world sit up and take notice. Here's a little context. The New York Times announced recently that it has 13 million subscriptions to its 50 newsletters. Weisberg and Zakin have 5 million subscribers who open just their one newsletter multiple times per week. I caught up with Carly and Danielle at The Skim's headquarters on 23rd Street in Manhattan to talk about their journey as business partners and friends, the roots of their entrepreneurial drive, and today's unique challenges for women in the startup game. Here are Carly Zakin and Danielle Weisberg.
So many people from a consumer-facing perspective have kind of resonated with the idea of the brand being the two of us starting from our couch, quitting our jobs, seeing a void in the market for news and matching it towards an audience that's influencing 80% of spending decisions out there. I think what is new is the way that we are, I think, articulating what we're really building. So I think for us, what we're recreating in some sense is a bundle around the idea of behavior. Like our product roadmap is really matched from the idea of a voice and what routines do people in this demographic, women 22 to 34, female millennials, what do they do every single day? And how can we bridge the two through technology?
Carly, sounds like a magazine.
That's an interesting way to think about it.
It's what magazines tried to do back before we had all these ways of reaching people.
I pause because we don't say magazine in many ways. Our former jobs were as TV producers. So we grew up idolizing morning TV, wanting to work on morning television, and thinking, especially as we made this transition to The Skim, thinking about what worked about morning television in its heyday. And what worked, when you deconstruct it, is it was 2 to 3 hours at some points, 2 to 3 hours of telling you, here's everything you need to know to be a person, be a functioning person. This is the news, this is the latest movie that's out, the book to read, how to cook your Thanksgiving turkey, this is the sports game, all of those things. And we all know that the delivery mechanism of that has shifted. The audience has shifted. Our audience is not watching morning TV in those ways anymore, but the producer in us still obviously finds the value in that. So, I think for us, what we are creating, to Danielle's point, is really a bundle of all the things you need to be an adult. And all of the things that you need that ultimately, if you are an adult in the Skim life, we are making it easier to live a smarter life.
And to be an adult this year, to be an adult today?
It's interesting. So I think the bigger part of that is how do we define our audience? And I think I'm giving us room to say, as a startup, we can always change our mind. But I think for us, the way that we define our audience is this demographic of female millennials. So 22 to 34 is not just the age range that we're focusing on. Mm-hmm. It is this demographic of people that graduated college when there was a recession or, just before or after, are living in that after effect. And they're looking at things very differently. How am I going to save to take care of my parents because their retirement funds may not be there? How am I going to set myself up for success if Social Security doesn't exist? How am I going to work my way through a career if I'm making 20% less than my parents, even though I'm more educated? Mm-hmm. How am I dealing with student loans? So I think that demographic for us is where we're focused, and those decisions are really going to define what adulting is as they move through those life stages. And I think we've built our whole brand around trust, around engagement, when all of the other media companies, or the bulk of them, really focused on mass media, in a sense, going after, you know, wide, shallow audience. We really decided to go focused and deep to really make sure that this audience of female millennials knows that they can trust us at a time when they're so critical of other sources out there.
Did you always know it was going to be deep? Because it's called the skim.
Yeah.
Which sort of implies it's a quick read.
I think what it implies is that we make it easy. And I think for us, you know, there were sort of two things that it implied. When we came up with the name, we went back and forth, like, does it have two M's? And we were like, you know what? The extra M is a little something extra. And I think that's what we are. We are a little extra something for people's day.
Yeah, that's because, yeah. I mean, we're taking out vowels in a lot of names these days.
Yeah.
You know,
we have not taken out a vowel yet.
No, you added a letter.
That's a startup. That's we like might take out a vowel. So we'll just be skim.
Yeah.
But for us,
adding an extra M.
But, so I think we have a little bit of something extra, but I also think that skim implies and kind of connotes that you're going to do something quickly. You're going to get the surface of something, and I think people take sometimes the surface the wrong way. Like, we are a gateway to learning more about the world around you, but we make it really easy and understand that time is the biggest commodity we all have and what we're all most protective of. So we are making it easier to live a smarter life by skimming it for you and by making it easier to make decisions, whether it's here's the news that you need in the world around you, these are the events that you need to know about are coming up and they're in your calendar, to these are the product recommendations that we're making. We are making it easier to be an adult.
5 million.
Over.
Yeah. Well,
we're not allowed to say
active.
How many, but
5 million active.
Yes.
And you define active users as
open a few times a week.
A few times a week. Mm-hmm. So once a week isn't enough.
No.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How? I mean, you were probably amazed at a million. You probably were panicking.
I mean, you have to go back. Like, we started this with $4,000 from our couch.
Yeah, we read every single subscriber's name, I would say, through the first few 100,000. Like, I weirdly know people's email addresses. And, like, we were at a dinner once recently, and a skin ambassador was like, my friend in Oklahoma, said he was the first one to sign me up for the skin. And I was like, when did he sign up? And it was like, in the first 6 weeks, he told me his name. I'm like, I remember that email address. And I'm not, like, making it up. Like, I remember what it was like to get the first 1,000, like that feeling, like the first 5,000, 8,000 to 50,000.
We also remember what it was like when people unsubscribe. Yeah. Like, we think about those in
just
terms,
so you know,
of like,
when people start companies, when you say, oh, I'm going to download your app, don't lie to your friend. They can see, and they will see when you unsubscribe. I know which friends unsubscribed. Like, we know which people unsubscribed.
But I think the point for us is that it's a very personal thing. Like, we remember each person as an individual, whether they felt like they could give us their time and attention, and that's something we take very seriously, or whether they didn't feel like we were worth it. And I think now, when we're 5 years in, it's still the same idea from like a leadership perspective, right? Like, we think about any statistic as like those individuals, like back in the day, we think about them. And I think as we've grown as a company, it's been the values that we had when it was just the two of us have still grown.
Hmm. Danielle, I want to understand why you. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, like, starting something is a bold move.
Yeah.
When so many of us are trained to go work for somebody else, get under a big brand, you did that, and then you decided to strike off and co-found something. Where did that entrepreneurial sense come from?
I think...
What's the first thing you started?
A lemonade stand when I was, like, 5 years old.
What town?
Chicago. And every year they would
have... City of Chicago? That sounds dangerous.
City of Chicago. I'm not going to say that. I love my hometown. It's fantastic. And every year they have an air and water show.
Right.
And it brings like a ton of tourists, and we lived right off of the water. Mm-hmm. So I would set up a lemonade stand at like the intersection of where all the tourists were, and would sell like lemonade for like way too much, and it was like, you know, the mixed lemonade, but
you know, kids,
was,
we buy lemonade,
yeah,
for
exactly,
way too much.
Yes, and I made a lot of money.
Like, how much?
I mean, I think it was like a couple hundred.
My what?
Yeah, I remember my little sister did it. we are 9 years apart, so she did it like the next wave when I outgrew being cute enough to do it. And she made enough on that weekend to buy a MacBook. She bought her first computer from that. Yeah. So I think for both of us,
I really started my lemonade stand in the wrong town.
Yeah, but I think for both of us, it was our parents. Like I think we connected as friends and also great business partners because our parents were always very much like, you have to have a job, you have to have an internship. You know, I think as young women, our moms always told us, like, you have to have your own way of making money, and that's really important.
You're getting too far ahead of me, though. Yeah. What did you do with that couple hundred dollars?
Oh, what did I do with it?
Yeah.
I think I gave it to my parents and they put it in a bank account. I don't have a good answer.
That's pretty good. Yeah. A bit of a saver. How old were you again?
I mean, I was little, like 5 or 6.
5 or 6?
Yeah. I mean, it was very much like my parents putting me out there, but it was, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And then you have a younger sister who's 9 years younger. Are your parents entrepreneurial? Like, what kind of environment did you grow up in business-wise?
It's interesting. My dad is very entrepreneurial, and I think I saw the ups and downs of what that was like.
How?
So he ran the Board of Trade in Chicago, and I think I saw a lot of that perspective of what can happen when technology comes in, and computers and online trading replacing a lot of people that were in the pit, and that was my dad's business. And then he went on to kind of start a few other companies with friends in different areas. And I saw, in a lot of ways, a great way for my dad about what having passion can do and having the freedom to create your own life. And also the downside of that, which is there's not a lot of stability and it's a big risk. My mom actually has been a huge example for me. So she was a stay-at-home mom when my sister and I were little. Mm-hmm. And then during the financial crisis, she definitely like started a new career for herself, and she went into real estate, which is a lot of branding yourself.
Yeah.
And so I think watching her do that later in life, when I was in an age, like I was in college, so it was very much a learning experience for me about what it takes to dig in and start something from scratch.
Hmm. Wow, Carly, lemonade stand?
Lemonade stand and iced tea, variety.
And iced tea.
Multi-prong revenue stream.
Yeah. Arnold Palmer's, any mixing of the lemonade and iced tea?
No.
Okay,
it's a little very too simple. Yeah.
What town for you?
My mom grew up in Neponset, which is right outside the Rockaways in Queens. So I used to go to stay with my grandparents every summer. And so I would do it right along the beach walk. And I would sit out there with my grandma and do it. I did not make a few hundred dollars at all. I remember like getting a 20 and being like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
So I put it in perspective. I did not buy a MacBook from it.
And what was the motivation for you? Was somebody saying, well, you know, let's show Carly how money works, or?
I think looking back, both of my parents and both sides of my family, my grandparents too, have an incredible work ethic. My grandfather worked every day till he was 95. He got on the bus every single day, came into Manhattan, was like, if I can walk, I can work. And
what did he do?
He was a jeweler. But all of my grandparents worked. And like also I think, you know, thinking back, that's actually pretty rare for like my grandmothers in terms of like the age that they, you know, grew up in. But they both worked and started their own businesses actually like later in life, which I think is really admirable. And actually I've never really thought about it before until right now, which is kind of amazing.
What kinds of businesses did they start?
My grandmother had a clothing and jewelry shop in a hair salon. And my other grandmother became an interior decorator later in life. And so all of them were entrepreneurial in one way or another. And my other grandfather was a window trimmer and like constantly reinvented himself like season to season. And so, you know, when we started this, people used to ask us, you know, are your parents entrepreneurs? And I would say no. And then when I think about it, I'm like, oh, of course they are. They have been. And it just wasn't, they didn't start a startup in the way that, you know, the tech scene startup. But I think all of the people in my family have an incredible work ethic. My dad still works 16-hour days in the office. Like we all just have a really great work ethic of being honest, of being of really knowing that if you put your name on something that like you have to defend it, and being someone, you know, my mom used to say, and her father told her, people are always going to talk about you, so make sure they talk about something good, and like make sure that you know if you put your name on it that like you're proud of it. And you know, and I used to try to like fake sick going to school when I was younger.
Didn't we all?
Yeah. No, I never did. When how, I used to try to do
how
that.
How elaborate did you get though?
I'm actually.
Did you heat the thermometer?
No, but I do have an idea for a future business one day, which is, I don't want to talk about it in too much detail, but I will tell you, I am very much looking to productize the excuses I gave growing up to not go to school. I think it's a really good idea, but that's neither here nor there. But I think that I remember my parents being like, you have a job, your job is to go to school. Like that you don't do, if you don't do that well, like you're failing at that. And it wasn't about like the grade, it was about like showing up for responsibility. And so I think that was instilled in me very early age. So I think going back to like a lemonade stand, or I used to, my mom started her own business and I literally worked for her since I was like 7 years old.
Business was that?
She started an event business and a fundraising business. And for charities. And she started it, you know, at home. Like I say, we joke, you know, we started on a couch. She started on a bed. She had a phone. She would make calls. I made her a desk in Woodshop and it said, I love you, Mom, on it. And that was cute. Her desk. And she had an intern from NYU sit at the desk in her bedroom. And it was just this idea of like, you do what you have to do. You need money to go to school, like you'll figure out how to do it. You need clothes, like figure out how to get it. And like you believe in something, you figure out how to bring it to light. And so I think that drive was always raised and reared in me. And I know like Danielle, the same thing.
What did you guys major in?
American Studies in English.
Okay.
I was film, political science, and creative writing.
So those are the majors that you're not supposed to
major.
I know.
Yeah, completely. Right? Yeah. Yeah, we talk about that a lot.
Yeah.
Like we're
the liberal arts cliche.
Yeah, I am
totally.
Too. But we're all employed.
Yeah.
So what about this advice that young people are getting these days to specialize, to pursue kind of this obvious path?
I think about this a lot because I have younger cousins, and it's really easy to be on the other side of things and be like, you know, don't major in that. You'll never get a job. Like, you know what? Like, I loved English. I loved film. I loved history. Like, I went down paths that helped me enrich that. But I figured out at a young age how to be entrepreneurial in those paths. And I think you have to have that. You don't have a choice not to have it. I don't know if I was doing it over. Like, I would probably take classes in a business school, but I don't think I would have majored in business.
So my little sister is now graduating college, and so we had this conversation last night where she was looking at how much it is to rent an apartment in Williamsburg. And
Brooklyn?
Yeah. And we talked about what her starting salary would most likely be in that liberal arts field, like communications, is it PR? It's not marketing, because that would be like too far in the finance world. So I think that the advice that I said to her, and I think I give people, is like, do what you're passionate about, but be realistic about how you're going to support yourself. Mm-hmm. So if you want to do something that you love and you feel like you can grow in that field, then make sure you love it enough to have that side hustle, to babysit on the weekends, to be a barista, to be a waitress, because I think that's the only way that I could go into journalism. Like, I waitressed after school for months so that I could afford to take a job that was $10 an hour without health insurance. And I think that that's the part that gets glossed over, which is it's a long way up that ladder, and you can totally do it, but you need to be able to, like, have that plan of how you're going to support yourself. And I think that that's something that we definitely talked about when we started our company. Like, we had to go into credit card debt. We talked about ideally what the jobs we would do. Like, I was going to be a DJ, which is a horrible idea because
DJ.
Well, I can't DJ, but I was just like, what's a job that
I will side hustle at night. I will
do
be
you
a
dance?
DJ.
Do you have really
no,
good music
no,
taste?
Like, there was nothing.
I really admired like the pluck.
Well, I was just like, what can I do at night? Like, that has weird hours. And then I'm going to take that back.
Sorry.
I'm going to rephrase that. But we then realized that we were working 20-hour days and we couldn't have like another job and get the business off the ground. So we had to go into credit card debt. So I think it's like, I totally, my heart goes out to people that like love writing and love editing and journalism and all PR and communications and all the jobs that like aren't the ones you're supposed to go into in this economy.
Right.
I totally think it's like, I want to tell people to do it, but also be realistic. Like, know what it takes to go into that, because you have to love it that much.
Carly, tell me about the moment that you met Danielle and your first impression.
We have the greatest meeting story. Yeah. We met in Rome.
In Rome?
Yep, not made up. We met in Italy. We did the same study abroad program in college, separate schools. We met because we were in like the student center in this little building. We were both looking for grilled fried artichokes in Rome. And we bonded.
Fried artichokes.
Yeah, they're known for fried artichokes. And we were both like talking to someone and we were like, oh, you're looking for the fried artichokes too? And I was like, me too. And we were like, let's go find them together. So that was the first time we met.
And we went back to Italy last weekend.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did you go to Rome or?
No.
It was our 5-year anniversary. Yeah.
Did you get fried artichokes?
Actually, no.
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 What was the best food? What was the best food you got this time in Italy?
Just pasta. Yeah. We had this amazing like homemade linguine with tomato sauce. It was like 3 types of tomato. It was just the greatest thing I've ever had.
It was great.
Why does this partnership work? Because a lot of them don't.
There's a few reasons. I think that we started this exactly in the same place in life and with the same amount of money. We own the same amount of the company. We've been very open. I mean, in many ways, like, this is a marriage. Like, our parents spoke before we started. Like, our parents met. Like, we consider each other's family's family at this point. We're very aligned in, like, what does success look like? We've constantly done check-ins along the way to make sure we're still aligned. And I think, you know, there's always going to be, like, when we started, like, you know, are we really aligned? Like, you know, having this kind of anxiety, like, how much can you trust another person? And I remember, like, consciously thinking to myself, there's going to be so many things that are going to stress us out over the next few years. The thing that I cannot afford to be stressed by is, like, do I trust this person? Mm-hmm. Like, it is just, like, that can never be a doubt or a worry or a point of insecurity. And I think we're very, very aligned. And I think that's something you work at all the time. But it's something we're very, very protective of.
You both have rings on your left hand ring fingers now, so something tells me you got married after getting business married. At what point does work-life balance start to become an issue for you as an entrepreneur? Because you're already, you know, starting off thinking about, oh, I'm working 20-hour days, great work ethic. That's wonderful for starting a business.
I don't think it has anything to do with significant others. I actually think it has a lot to do with, like, your personal sanity.
But I think there's also, like, I feel a little bit like we, as women, in a sense, have, like, also a responsibility to point out that we don't have kids. So, like, I think a lot of that, I don't know how to, like, we look at our advisors that have kids and they're running their company and they started their company and they got married and they had children and they're doing it all. And those are the people that I look at and I'm constantly like, wow, I think I'm having trouble balancing things, but, like, how do you do it in that next stage of life? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, like, yes, so much. I mean, we were 25 years old when we started this. We were worried about paying our rent and we were worried that we made a huge mistake in, like, our careers in some sense. But we didn't have, like, those bigger, real worries, in a sense. We didn't have a mortgage. We knew that we need to get ourselves out of, like, credit card debt. But it's, I think when people come to us and they ask us about work-life balance, it's almost like I also want to, like, caveat that I feel like we were in a life stage where we could afford to take those risks and to work 20-hour days.
But I also think our awareness of finding balance didn't come from another person. It came from ourselves. It had nothing to do with, like, external factors. It was that we were running ourselves into the ground. I mean, you can only run on adrenaline for so long. And, you know, we're 5 years old at this point, or about to be 5. And that's a huge, huge moment for a business, especially a startup in this climate. And, like, something I think what I'm most proud of is that, like, we're still functioning. Like, we're still here.
Yeah.
Like, the first few months, I mean, we were gonna drop. Like, we hadn't worked out, we weren't sleeping, we weren't eating well.
I went home to Chicago, like, 6 months after we started the company, and my parents hadn't seen me. And they were like, oh, you need to, like, take care of yourself. You look awful. And I think that a lot of it is we're really close with our families. So if they don't see us, or, like, we're going off the grid, like, they call us out on everything. I think it's also just a sense of I remember someone said this to us, and it took me a while to like figure out what it meant, but like, if you're not alive, there is no company, which like is, you know, like an obvious sense, but it's also we're serving a demographic that we also represent.
Right.
So if we're not out there like living life and experiencing these different things, then how can we create products that fit into our audience's day to day?
Do you guys have distinct roles that you either had from the beginning or have emerged over time?
Yes and no. So I think we're both co-CEOs, we're co-founders. Mm-hmm. We are co-editors in chief. So there's a lot of similar skill set that there are things that we just do really well together. Like when we create products, when we talk about The Voice, like those are all things that we have come together to start. And that's why we created the company as partners. I think the day to day we split up. And that's something that took a while because we do have the same skill set. So it was kind of an evolution. It was lots of conversations over time. But we're also very clear that like our job is to communicate with each other all day long so that we can jump in. And if I'm spending more time on the media part of the business and Carly's spending much more time on the subscription part of business, that we can jump in and out because we keep each other up to date all day long.
Hmm. Carly, at what point did the business model become clear? Was it clear from the beginning or...
It was, I would say certain parts of it were really clear in the beginning. We've talked a lot about what we didn't know, like as a, you know, as founders, first time doing everything. And I think we've spoken really publicly about that. But I think there were a few things that we really did know. One was like, we knew email was going to be a marketing tool for us. We knew the audience, we knew how to talk to them.
Why did you know that?
I can't explain it. It was truly instinct. We just knew it.
Well, but I think it goes back to like, we are the audience. Yeah. So we knew how we woke up. We knew how we wanted to get information delivered to us. And we knew how much time we had before
we
ran out the
door. Also knew, I mean, I'll say like, we were very well aware. There's a lot of people who've done email newsletters and monetized with advertisers. Like that's right. Innovative.
Yeah.
We didn't think, oh my God, look what we figured out how to do. We had the benefit of talking to a lot of those founders and saying, what worked for you? If you had to do it over today, what would you do? And so with that, we knew email had to be a marketing vehicle for us. And we knew, like I would say day one was, we knew if we got a really loyal base, we would be able to activate them in a certain way to monetize them. We didn't know exactly how we would activate them, but that was the plan. Over time, it became much clearer, okay, this is gonna become a sponsorship part, this is gonna become a subscription part, this is gonna become the community that we have. Those things, I would be shocked if anyone could have predicted all of those things. Those things came to light over the last few years.
We're celebrating the 10-year anniversary of the modern smartphone. The iPhone was introduced in what? I guess it was June 29th. Of 2007.
Very impressed that you know that.
Mm-hmm. I've been covering technology for a while. and you know how we journalists are about anniversaries. It's an excuse to tell a story.
Yeah.
So you guys are 5 years old. Mm-hmm. You were sort of born at the halfway mark.
Yeah.
How important has the mobile lifestyle been to the evolution of the skim?
I think it's everything.
It's everything. I mean, our audience, on average, looks at their phone 126 times a day.
How do you know?
Read some stuff. Journalists. it's everything. I think what we are really good at is understanding this audience and understanding this audience's routines. Because a lot of it is our own routines. It's the people who work here's routines. And it's the community that we talk to all the time's routines. So we're more addicted to our phones now than we were 5 years ago. I watch stuff on my phone now. I didn't even do that 2 years ago. I listen to podcasts now. Didn't do that 6 months ago.
Podcasts? It's crazy.
Yeah. So, it's so weird.
Always listen to this.
But I don't know if you should think about doing one. But I think for us, you know, we are very in tune to what are we doing on our phones. And not only our phones, but like what are the other moments in our day when we have a second to either have a question or have a second to learn something, and what are the mediums for delivery for that?
Hmm. How are you guys different?
It's interesting. I think that we have really similar skill sets, as we talked about. I think we're different people. Like, we have different personalities.
I think you're different people too.
Yeah, but I think. I think it takes people that work with us some time or like that work with us as a company, so our investors, or you know, we're very in sync when we create things together, but we have different points of view. We handle things differently. I think I'm from the Midwest. I think I'm very like personable up front. Carly has more of that New York, you know.
A little bit more of a wicked sense of humor.
I couldn't hear you.
Perhaps? Wicked sense of humor?
I think that is like what people see, and I think that we're kind of flipped in some ways mm-hmm. when people actually get to know us. But I think one way we're really similar, which actually has driven a lot of the company vision, is that we're both introverts who have had to become extroverts. Like when we thought about what we were going to do for a living, if anyone had told us like it would involve being on camera or speaking all the time on behalf of something, that's like terrifying. And not, I mean, we were producers. We were happy to be behind the camera. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would echo all of that. I think we have, we always have the same end goal, but I think how we get there is sometimes different.
I also
eat
cheese. You guys
are drawing very sharp lines of distinction, I have.
I was going to say, I also eat cheese. So, yeah.
We have different, totally different eating habits.
Aside from the artichokes.
Yes, aside from artichokes.
Oh, we're also, I am a procrastinator, like 110%. And Carly, she has to get things, like.
I also, I think our thought processes are different. Like, I'm very reactive in the moment. I love, like, a freestyle brainstorm. And I'm like, what about this? Oh, my God, let's do this. Done. Like, let's go. And Danielle likes to take it all in. And she likes to ask kind of all the questions to everyone she could ask and then make her own opinion, where I'm very quick to be like, that's my feeling. That's my gut feeling, for better or worse. So I think sometimes that's, like, interesting as we, you know, make product decisions or make decisions in the company.
How does that affect the way you engage with investors?
Oh, investors, it doesn't. Yeah. Like, we're very much a united front when we talk to investors. I think we're lucky that we have, I think Homebrew Ventures led our seed round. And we've done a lot of product brainstorms with them because they were former heads of product from Twitter and YouTube. And it's actually interesting that they have a co-founder dynamic as well. So I think when we've done, like actually gone deep with investors, which is a different relationship than just like dealing with the board, then they see it come out. But day to day, like we have the exact same response to mm-hmm. how we run the business and how we deal with our investors.
Yeah.
How did that relationship with Homebrew start?
We started in July of 2012, and we met like a whole new network of people. So we met someone named Rich Greenfield, who's on here mm-hmm. a lot, and he's a media analyst, and he was one of the first people to believe in us, and he wrote us a check for angel investment. And
you met him where?
Sorry?
You met him where?
We met him, backtrack. We took a class at Skillshare, ironically.
Which is?
It was a class on how to meet a business partner, and we did not need that.
But Skillshare, for the people who don't know, what is it?
Oh, so Skillshare is a series of, I would say, classes or courses or workshops to acquire a specific skill. So we took a class, we thought on like how to start a business. It turned out the focus was how to find a business partner. It was the only thing that we actually had in our favor. So maybe not the best use of time, but we actually met the teacher in that class, became an immediate friend, and the person that we actually told the idea of the skip to first. So his name was Alex Taub. Alex Taub introduced us to a woman named Lori Racine, and she had kind of been in lots of different startups and just a really wonderful mentor, especially to female entrepreneurs. And she was the first person that we met that she got it. And she was like she's, you know, one of our dearest friends now. And she knew Rich Greenfield, introduced us to Rich because she knew Rich's cousin or something. And we met Rich, and he wrote us a check, I think the fourth month in. So a small angel investment, and he ended up introducing us.
So what did you have 4 months in?
We had about 25,000 subscribers.
That's good.
We had a lot of brands wanting to reach us.
And I mean, anything that we had was just from the two of us writing at night and literally going to college campuses, coffee shops, gyms, and dropping off like flyers during the day.
Flyers that said what?
They sent up for the skim.
Yeah.
With like our logo. We printed t-shirts for like 20 of our friends throughout the country.
It said, "We read you skim."
And we asked them to wear them to like whatever they did during the day and to take pictures of themselves and put it on social media with these shirts. So the traction that we had was all just based off of like us thinking about grassroots. How do you grow? How do you hear about things?
Rich ended up introducing us to everyone that filled our seed round over, like by accident. We met lots of people who said no, and it turned out everyone who said yes came from Rich in the end of the day. So we met Homebrew Ventures the following summer. We flew out. It was funny. We talked to them on the phone. They were really nice, but we had had experience in the Valley that like no one understood it, and we had no money. So taking a trip to the West Coast was really expensive.
The experience in the Valley that nobody understood it. This is spring from the fact that we're 5 years into the smartphone era, and everybody's like email.
I think a lot of things. We were first time entrepreneurs.
Okay. It wasn't just one thing. So, like, yes, it was email, but it was also content.
It was
like,
the audience you were going after.
Oh, they hated content.
Yeah, exactly.
they all hated content. They hated email. They thought women were a niche market. That was said to us. I can't even tell you how many times.
We're not engineers, so, like, that was a huge strike against
us. So there were a lot of reasons we didn't feel like we could afford to make another trip to San Francisco. But then Rich actually was like, you know, you should circle out back with those guys from Homebrew. Like, I don't think you followed up with them. And we were like, okay, fine. They're like, can you come out to California? And I remember we were like, this is just another thing going on our credit card that we won't be able to pay off. And we went for one day. Like, we got on the plane, landed at, you know, 10:30. We were getting back on the plane at 4. And we had lunch with them. And it was, like, the best first date. It was, we were literally, they were the two of us. And they have a co-founder relationship. And it was, they got it. And we got it. And, like, by the time we got to the airport, they were like, we'll write you a term sheet.
And they asked us if we could order for each other.
Which we could, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, we were like, this is the easiest test ever. Yeah.
Like, this is a great meeting.
Yeah.
Fried artichokes.
Yeah.
No nuts, no cheese.
At that point, you get an investment and you do what with it? It sort of allows you to forget about the DJ gig?
Yes. Well, at that point...
Not yet, really.
I mean, at that point, we had so much traction, like, organically.
Yeah, but I don't think it didn't solve our financial, like, concerns.
Personally, no. But it, from the business perspective, it allowed us to hire. So we hired our first... 5 people and then 7
people.
We got
an office.
Who's your first office?
We hired an assistant, half office manager, half someone for Skin Ambassador Management. And then we hired that person the same day as we hired our current head of analytics. It was funny, we were told to find a growth hacker, and we had never heard that phrase. We talked to a lot of people in New York. They had never heard that phrase. Everyone in San Francisco was like, growth hacker, of course, I've got time. And we had no idea what everyone was talking about. And so we reached out to someone on LinkedIn.
And a growth hacker is somebody who figures out how to get that virtuous cycle.
Understanding
who our best users are and how to get more.
Mm. Yeah, and that hasn't changed.
Yeah.
What hasn't changed?
That job description. Even, you know, the same objective we had out of that role in 2013 is the same one that we have now.
I remember, and it was like January 2nd, right? Yeah. And we did our kickoff meeting in our first office, which was January 2nd, 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, 2014.
2014. And our first office was a little bit bigger than the size of this room, which is not big. And we came in and we got a teal plastic picnic blanket, and we got
champagne
and bagels, and we didn't have desks, so like the three of us, four of us sat on the floor and just talked about like what we were going to build, and then we had to build our desks.
We had two desks that were used.
Well, Carly had desk building experience.
We bought them wood shop actually, but these were plastic.
I love you, Mom. I remember.
Thank you.
We got them from a startup that had failed, and we remember thinking about, we're really superstitious, so we were like, do we like buy these? Is it bad karma to bring it in? But
then we got help putting the others together.
What's the best decision you made in the first year?
Starting the company.
Besides that?
Letting our community evolve. We had naming it Skin Ambassadors. We had all these people writing into us. And when we thought about like how to start, community was like, if we had to prioritize our list, community was like number 5. literally day one, people started writing in, I've never written to anything before, I love what you do. And we had pen pal relationships with people. And someone gave us advice, asked them to share. So we were like, okay. Then they shared, and then we started having a referral program. And so then they started calling themselves brand ambassadors, and we said, call yourself a Skimbassador. And within months, we had hundreds of people around the country calling themselves Skimbassadors. And now we have a program over 25,000 strong that no one has a program like this. And they bring in about 20% of our annual growth. I think that was an
incredible. Why do they do it?
You have to ask them, but I think that there's a few different reasons. One is, I think they believe in the mission. They want the swag that comes with it. Like, literally, there's great prizes. But also, they're
like,
a sweatshirt, a t-shirt,
a wine tumbler.
But also, a community has evolved from it, where they are getting jobs from each other. They're meeting each other in real life. They're getting roommates, career advice. And they're getting first access to everything in the company. And
I think the best thing that we did was do our fundraise ourselves.
Yes.
Like in the first year of the company, or at least try to. And I think that that was...
There's a lot of consultants that come out of the woodwork and are like, for a little bit of equity, I'll do your fundraise. And we thought about it because that was not an area that we were strong in. We never used Excel before.
But I think that set our tone as executives and managers and leaders. And that changed how we thought about ourselves. And that changed the trajectory of the company as being one that is run by people that understand the editorial vision because we created it, and we are, just because we did that doesn't mean that we can't also create the business. And then I think at that time that was a huge sticking point, was like, oh, you know, you can write and you can create a voice and you can create a brand, so you need someone else to do the business side. And I think that decision in the first year to decide that we were people that could do both, even though we hadn't done it before, was huge.
There's a lot of recent buzz in tech about women entrepreneurs and how difficult it is.
Yeah.
Whether, and women in tech in general and how difficult it is. The Medium post on Uber from Susan Fowler that went viral and caused a lot of cultural changes there. And then more recently, the dust up over the venture capitalist who was sexually harassing entrepreneurs who were coming to him. Your take on the environment for women right now and the barriers that need to be removed to create more the Skims.
I have a few thoughts.
I think the biggest thing that we've seen actually is that you have to get more women investing and in more actual positions to allocate dollars. And I think when we started, like, we did not see, I mean, 5 years ago, there were really like maybe two women that we met with, and we met with hundreds of people that said no. And I think two of them were women that could actually write the check for their company. And I think one of the things that we see is...
Do either of them say yes?
No.
No. There are a very small amount of our investors that are women, and all of our advisors are women. And when we started, it was very, I think we see it's a lot, we've seen it be a lot harder for women to be the ones to write that check or to invest. And I think there's a lot of reasons why, but I think we need to put women in those positions and we need to make sure that they are doing it.
There's clearly systemic issues in this industry. And it's not, you know, before tech, it was Wall Street. I mean, so this isn't, you know, this isn't just exclusive to tech. It's really apparent in tech right now, but what's going to be the industry after this? So it's a top down bottom up approach. Like, women need to be in computer science classes. Women at the top of these companies need to be empowered to be making the decisions, to be able to write the checks. But I think the other thing, you know, we've seen right now, there's this almost, I hate to say trend, but of everyone kind of on high alert to be aware, finding, you know, like, I'm fighting against the sexism in the industry. We were talking to someone who was bragging to us that he won't speak at a panel unless women are on the panel, as if that was going to cure the sexism in the tech industry. And it's like, the panel is not the point. Like, that's not the issue. The issue is, like, are you hiring women for you? Are you making sure that, like, the women that are interns for you are actually taking computer science classes, whether or not they want to be an engineer or not? Are you promoting women to be at the top? And so I think it's about it's a top-down, bottom-up approach, and it's not about these kind of publicity moments of, you know, we have, you know, if we get invited to one more Women in Tech event, like, that doesn't mean anything. Some of them are wonderful and some of them are great, but that's not solving the issue per se.
I think it's also owning the issue in a real way. Like, and that goes into, I think a lot of what's done has
owning
been...
Owning it, meaning who needs to own it in a real way?
I think there needs to be more of a collaborative part of Silicon Valley in some sense that comes together and creates something that like actually looks at where the issues are and solves it, not on a, I mean, it would be great if it was a business to business way of doing it, but we also know like we're running a startup and we have so little time to think about things. Like it's hard to get your head above water.
It's a collaborative process. I mean, I think people don't even realize that they have prejudices towards women. Like sometimes I don't even realize that certain things that are happening are actually sexist and are happening to us. Like we had a meeting this morning with someone who, you know, was a big deal in the media industry, and his female partner was there, and he was 25 minutes late, and she said, this never would have happened if a man was meeting with them. And I didn't even think about it. And I was like, well, I don't know, maybe you're right. And maybe she's right, maybe she's wrong. But I think it's like pointing those things out to one another. You know, we've had people tell us, you know, we're being emotional. You don't say that to male founders.
Right.
We've had people to ask us, you know, when do you plan on getting married and have children? Like, when do you ever ask that to a male founder?
Well, and also
offering... I try to ask family questions of both.
Well, the way that we've been asked the question was, you know, I'd like to buy some secondary for you, and it'll help you pay for your wedding.
We've been told, you know,
I mean, like,
when,
really,
in,
like,
in
that's,
a diligence yeah. process, do yeah. you have any ex-boyfriends that might come kill you, like that girl at UVA?
Oh, my goodness.
I think it's also, I mean, we've been asked, like, what is your, in relation to, you know, like, future raises or, you know, future investment, like, when do you guys think you'll have kids?
Yeah.
Like, you can see the math in these people's heads that are asking the question about...
And I will say, but I think the most important thing is it's not just men asking those things.
Right.
And that's, I think, what we're talking about of, like, everyone, it's a collaborative fix that needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Entrepreneurs need to be able to feel empowered to call people out on that and not feel scared, which is why it's really amazing that a lot of brave people are coming forward and saying, this is my name and this is, I was sexually harassed. Whereas there's a lot of founders who didn't feel the confidence to be able to come forward. And, you know, on those less extreme cases where it's on us as much as those people to say that's inappropriate or to call out your coworker and say, just so you know that was sexist. You don't realize, but you wouldn't have said that to a man.
Right.
And I think, reality is most people aren't assholes. I don't know if I could say assholes. I'll say it again.
Sure.
But most people
this
aren't.
This is like more cable than
great.
Cable.
Yeah. But most people aren't intentionally assholes. So you sometimes need to help each other point out, hey, you're doing something that's inappropriate.
But it's also, I think part of it too, is not it's not just a gender
yes.
thing. It's a diversity thing in general.
Yes.
And I think that that's how the problem needs to be viewed, is how do we get people that have different viewpoints, because it's going to make the companies that you are creating stronger. And it's a business perspective, right? Like, this isn't just like we need to be nice to women or we need to get more people of color into our companies because it looks good. It's because it's actually better for what you're creating and it's going to be building a stronger business. And I think that frustrates me, that like we all want to be good people and we want to help people up, but it's also like there is a, if you're an investor and you're looking at a business, like you should be investing in the ones that...
On the flip side, I will say the number one thing I hate is when we interview people and I say, why do you want to work at the skin? And they're like, I want to be at a female-founded business. Like, what does that mean? Don't tell me you like my company because I'm a woman, like, and I founded it. Tell me why you love the skin. So it goes both ways. And I think to me, that's the equivalent of saying, I won't do a panel because a woman's not on it.
But I think there's a difference between what I was saying, which is like,
we're obviously very passionate about this.
No, but it's like, but investing in a company because it goes after an audience that's influencing 80% of spending decisions is a good business decision.
Mm-hmm.
Like right. that is, and totally. That's the part that's missing from like this conversation about why diversity is important, because it's also driving good economic decisions.
Yeah, but it's got to be smart diversity.
Yeah.
Right? Because
yes.
Yeah, yes. I look at, there was that Pepsi ad dust up.
Yeah.
Was it Kendall Jenner?
Mm-hmm.
I forget
it was
the
Kendall.
Different.
It was Kendall.
And I thought, you know, I'll bet you there was like a black person in the room,
mm-hmm.
but maybe there wasn't a real diversity of thought. Like, you can't just assume that because you've got the boxes checked, that frees you from the responsibility to think around corners and to be critical and to even walk a mile still in the other person's moccasins. It's not like, well, we got all the different size moccasins in here, so
No, so that's totally true. But I think the conversation has to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think encouraging people to actually talk about these things and have these conversations and to talk about, like, exactly what you said, it's smart diversity rather than just diversity. I feel like the way that tech as an industry is portraying the problem is like, there's one fix or there's one solve, or if we do this and this, then we're good. And it's really like, it has to be something that people feel like they can talk about, and we don't know the best way to solve this. So like, as an industry, we need to start thinking about ways and having those honest conversations, and not just when something hits the news because someone said something harassment and there's a new story.
Last question, biggest mistake.
Sometimes thinking too much. I think we took too long to roll out Skim Ahead because we had all these ideas we want to do at once, and we were like, this has to be perfect, we have to do everything at once, there's so much riding on it.
Skim Ahead, is that the...
That's our subscription app, which you can get in the Apple Store for $2.99 a month, 90 days free. But I think we went into analysis paralysis and overthinking things. That's a regret I have.
I think it's the same thing, just like taking too long and sitting on our ideas and not testing things, like not getting things out there just in general. And that's all different parts of the company, whether it's like, we think a lot about our hiring plan, and I think that's great, and we have an amazing culture, which we're really proud of. But I also think if we had hired people to test things and, you know, like moved faster, could we have made mistakes and failed faster in different ways? And I think instead we were so thoughtful about every single thing that it slowed us down. I think maybe not embracing failure as much as we should have early on.
Well, thanks for the time.
Thank you for the story.
I think it's going to be inspirational to a lot of people.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Good question. Thank you.
All right, that was good.
Thanks so much. I have no idea.
Yeah. Wow, 50 minutes.
My thanks to Danielle Weisberg and Carly Zakin. I'm John Fort from CNBC, and this has been Fort Knox, rich ideas and powerful people. Subscribe on Apple's podcast app, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Please do leave a review if you enjoyed this. Also, check out Fort Knox Live on Facebook, Twitter, Periscope, and YouTube. I'm taking your comments and questions, usually Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. There I tackle some of the most interesting business and economic issues with a little help from my friends at CNBC and from you. Meanwhile, share this. Tell a friend. Drop me a note on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, or FortKnox.com. That's FortKnox.com. And as always, thank you for lending an ear.